Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, we talk with State Representative Javier Martinez about his remarkable journey from Juarez, Mexico, to a UNM law degree, then as a state rep and community organizer for Albuquerque South Valley, and now as one of New Mexico's leading legislators. Javier Martinez, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Stephen. Pleasure to be with you.
Later in the show, I'd like to ask you about two of the very controversial bills you successfully sponsored. First, tapping the $22 billion permanent fund to expand early childhood services. And second, legalizing cannabis, including expunging convictions. But let's start with your remarkable journey, which I believe starts in Juarez. And maybe you could explain how it was that your family was living in Juarez.
Well, you know, my family has been migrating north for as long as we can remember. Both my grandparents came from the southern part of Chihuahua State. They came up to the borderland, to the Juarez El Paso area, where they found work back in the 40s and 50s. My parents were born, my mother was born in El Paso. My father was born in Juarez. My father started migrating north to the United States when he turned 18, you know, looking for work, generally in construction. And then we migrated here when I was 8 years old. I was born in El Paso. You know, a lot of people don't know this about the border, but back then, a lot of Mexican families came and had their children on this side, and then they'd go back and live in Juarez or, you know, whatever town on the other side of the border. And we were no different. You know, that's what my parents did. And eventually we ended up here in Albuquerque. And this has been home since.
You were 8 years old when you migrated to Albuquerque, to the U.S. So how were you able to do that? How was your family able to come?
Well, you know, my father worked in construction, and they at the time would work sort of the circuit between Albuquerque, Tucson, Odessa, Colorado Springs. Eventually they settled here in Albuquerque. I'm assuming work was a little bit more stable here at the time. And so
it's just this fluid border again, moving back and forth.
Very fluid. You know, it's interesting because for our family, roots have never been laid in one community for more than one generation, right? So I might be changing that. I don't have any plans of leaving New Mexico.
So you said you were 8 years old when you came here. So does that mean you started school in Mexico?
I did. I started actually in Mexico at the time. They had a pre-K, pretty robust pre-K program. So I actually started kindergarten or pre-K at four. And then went through kindergarten, first, second grade, and then moved here the summer between second and third grade. So I started the third grade here at the La Mesa Elementary in the International District.
So how was your English at that time?
Well, it was non-existent. we had great teachers, and, you know, they had a very good ESL program at the time. And, you know, for the first couple of years, and they would pull me out of the regular class to go do ESL for a few hours a day. And by the time I was in fifth grade, I didn't have to go to ESL anymore.
You continue on in public school, right, from the fifth grade on?
I do. I go through Hayes Middle School, sixth, seventh, eighth grade, and then Highland High School. I'm a proud Hornet class of 1999.
And then you go to UNM, and I'm just wondering, what year did you go to UNM?
Well, I was admitted to UNM and started in the fall of 1999. I was only the second or third class to benefit from the lottery scholarship. So that was a big deal.
Wow.
For me. I got to serve with Senator Michael Sanchez for a couple of years. And I made sure he knew that because of the work that he and others did on the lottery scholarship, people like me were able to go to college.
So UNM was affordable for you at that time?
UNM was affordable for me. That's right.
So then at some point, you become a community organizer. When was that?
You know, that was between my between my first and second year of college. You know, when I started college, I was working in retail. I was working for an AutoZone, a job that I enjoyed very much. I got to learn a lot about cars, skill sets that I still use to this day. But I was looking for something different at the time, right? I was really beginning to enjoy college life, getting involved in student movements at UNM, particularly the Lambda Theta Phi Latino Fraternity, as well as MECHA and other organizations. And so I realized that, you know, in order to really have that kind of exposure to that student movement that I was a part of, you know, I couldn't really do that and have a regular, you know, retail job with hours and schedules and whatnot. So I quit that job in the spring of 2001 and was unemployed for a few months. That summer, I got connected to an organization at the time called Albuquerque Partnership with Dr. Moises Venegas, who founded the organization. And he gave me a chance and gave me my first organizing job back that summer. And I've never looked back.
So a lot of people know what maybe a political organizer is, but what is a community organizer?
Oh, that's a fantastic question, Stephen. You know, they're very different. Political organizing tends to be very transactional. It tends to have a goal in mind, and that is to elect the candidate of your choosing. Community organizing is really about building a movement and reclaiming our power as a community. You know, it is oftentimes said that, you know, there's organized people and there's organized money in the world. And those are the two power structures that we deal with in communities of color, low-income communities. Obviously, we don't have access to the money, but we have access to the people. And when ordinary people organize themselves, they can do extraordinary things. And that's what drew me to the work. You know, understanding that as people in poverty, we still have power. And it's just a matter of exercising that power and seeking the change that we want to see.
Well, I want to pick up on that. But before I do, let me just mention that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and with me today is Javier Martinez. Javier started his career, or started his life really, in Juarez. He then came to Albuquerque. He moved on as a community organizer, then a state representative, and now is one of our leading legislators. And Javier, you were talking right before the break about what community organizations can do. And the name of you're actually now the executive director of the organization, and it's called the Partnership for Community Action. And so what are the things that, specific things that you've done at the Partnership for Community Action?
Yeah, Partnership for Community Action is actually the same organization that first hired me, at the time known as the Albuquerque Partnership. I started out as a youth intern, and now I have the great pleasure and honor of directing the organization along with a group of amazing people. We work primarily with immigrant families with young children. And what we do is we work with those families to reconnect them to their leadership, to reconnect them to their power. And we work with those families to build opportunities for engagement, both in the civic process and beyond. You know, we do a number of different programmings across the county. And we do, currently we're engaged in a social enterprise center. We're actually building a multi-million dollar building in the heart of the South Valley.
And that enterprise center is an amazing achievement by you guys.
Thank you. You know, as a community organization, you know, we rely a lot on philanthropic funding, you know, individual giving. But, you know, that is not sustainable, you know, and we've always made the case that organizations have to build sustainability into their model. And this is the way in which we're doing it. You know, so we're excited about the work, and we're excited about the next 20 years of our work. I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
So it sort of seems like a natural thing that when Rick Miera decides not to run again for the House, that you decide to run, because it's sort of an evolution of what you were already doing, correct?
Yeah, you know, in our work is inherently political, right? We have to push the system to be responsive and to be, to be at the service of the community of people. And so when Representative Miera decided not to run again, the first call I made was to my wife. And quite frankly, she would have made a much better representative than I ever could. But she wasn't able to at the time. So she said, you should do it. And so I did. And I'm glad. And to this day, I'm in awe of that magnificent place that is the state legislature and of the amazing leaders that serve there, including Representative Miera. I have big shoes to fill. And I'm not even close to getting to the place where he was when by the time he retired.
So what year did you actually first run to take that seat?
I ran in 2014 and started service in 2015.
So you've been reelected three more times since then, correct?
That's correct.
So now you're the head of the, I think it's called the Taxation and Revenue Committee, is that right?
You're the chair. That's correct, yes.
So if one had to guess what a socially conscious legislator would try to be the head of, probably the first guess wouldn't be taxation and revenue. So how did you pick that committee is what you wanted to do?
That's another great question, Stephen. After my first election, we get to request which committees we want to be on. It's never guaranteed, obviously. It's always the purview of the speaker. My natural, as an attorney, as an organizer, my natural inclination was to go to the Judiciary Committee or maybe the Consumer and Public Affairs Committee. But I remember the conversation I had with myself, right? And that conversation really centered around how do I expand my own professional horizons, right? And how do I take my perspectives of racial and economic justice into the legislature in a way that really begins to shift the balance of power when it comes to state finances. And so the two committees to do that in obviously are the appropriations committees, whether it's on the House or Senate side, or the Taxation and Revenue Committee, which is the one that I was actually placed on. At the time, it was known as a Ways and Means Committee. Remember that when I got elected, I came in the minority party, the Republicans had just taken over the House. And so I served 2 years under Republican leadership. And then once we took the House back, I served as both as a ranking member and then a vice chair, and then now as a chair.
So it became obvious to me in your answer that we left something out of your biography. Along the way, you also graduated from UNM Law School, correct?
Yeah, I did. A great education with incredible teachers and professors, including Margaret Montoya, who would later go on to become my mother-in-law, or I would go on to become her son-in-law, which made it very difficult because I feel like she graded me with extra scrutiny once I started dating her daughter.
Well, she's been an incredible voice for minority people for a long time.
She has been. And New Mexico should really treasure, I think, the contributions of Professor Montoya. She was the first Latina admitted to Harvard Law School back in the 70s and has really built a tremendous following, not only across the nation, but across the world in the work that she's done around critical race theory.
So now that you're the head of this Tax and Revenue Committee, that actually gives you also a seat on the Legislative Finance Committee, and that actually gives you some power over not only almost all the legislation that affects revenues, but also over the entire state budget and what agency gets what, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And, in fact, we start meeting this week, Thursday, Friday. LFC will meet for the first time this year, and we'll start working on the 2022 budget in earnest. So it is an honor to serve in that position, and it does give me a front row seat view of our state finances.
So I'm sort of interested in how one makes their way up in the ranks in the House, which you have obviously done. And I'm guessing one of the ways is just to be a workhorse, to really do the work outside the session. I'm not sure everybody realizes that a lot of legislators do a lot of unpaid work, basically, outside of the actual sessions.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of work involved. You know, I've been fortunate to work with an amazing group of people, from the speaker to his staff and several of our other committee chairs. And I've learned a lot from them. You know, they've been in the trenches for much longer than I have. And so as an organizer, you got to know when to speak and you've got to know when to listen. And I feel like my organizing training has really prepared me, I think, for the legislative world. And it's afforded me with the patience that is needed to really be successful. You know, case in point, House Joint Resolution 1. I mean, that took us 10 years to pass, right? But patience is really the name of the game, I think.
Well, I'd like to come back and talk with you about that bill and the two other pieces of legislation that you successfully sponsored and passed. Not that you only did that for two, but we only have time to touch on a few of them, and I picked three that I wanted to touch on. But let me mention first that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. I'm here with Javier Martinez, someone who has made, I think, the true American story journey from Juarez, Mexico to Albuquerque to UNM Law School to the legislature, and now he's a leading legislator. Do you want to describe a little bit what the constitutional amendment does?
Yeah, you know, the constitutional amendment, House Joint Resolution 1, is a proposal that the voters will now have the opportunity to vote on to increase the distribution from New Mexico's Land Grant Permanent Fund, which is one of the largest funds of its kind in the world, currently valued at $22 billion. The additional distribution would go, for the most part, to support early childhood and expand early childhood programming across the state, beginning with the earliest years, things like home visitation, childcare, pre-K, and a host of other services that are needed in order to ensure that children have a healthy start to their lives. The amendment needs to be passed by the legislature before it gets to the voters. And after a 10-year battle this past legislative session, we were able to finally get it out of the legislature and onto the voters.
So I just sort of have a question. Is it really pertains more to you as a sponsor than the substance of the constitutional amendment, which is this. But, you know, by the time 2021 arrived, as you said, it's been there for 10 years, there were very few legislators who didn't espouse a belief in early childhood that it would be beneficial to the state and to the people that participated. But their objection was that the impact on the permanent fund. Even though the fund had been growing from like 11 to 13% per year, they thought maybe 1% was too much to take out of it. And yet in order to pass it, those same opponents insisted that it be raised to 1.25% and that 0.5% would go through K through 12. And I guess maybe this is just how sausage gets made or how you build coalitions, but it's sort of difficult to understand as an outsider.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that you're right. You know, for the longest time we were asking for 1%, we were told that was too much. In all candidness, I don't think it was ever a matter of it being too much. I just don't think they wanted to redistribute that kind of money from the permanent fund back to young children and particularly children of color. I think once the politics and once the elections took their toll on some of these folks, then it became apparent that not only were we going to be able to get the 1% for early childhood, but that potentially we could get a little bit more for those later years, right? Those elementary school years and whatnot. So we're excited. And we're happy, but you know, all the credit in the world goes to the amazing advocacy groups, particularly Mr. Alan Sanchez and Jessa Cowdery at St. Joseph's Children, and so many other folks, Voices for Children, and others who really invested time, money, sweat, tears to get this done. This is really a victory for the children of New Mexico, delivered by those amazing advocates.
So I sort of have another sort of sponsor type question, sort of a nuts and bolts type question, on the legalizing cannabis. There was, you know, there was the legalizing, regulating, and taxing cannabis, and you could sort of put that in one bucket. And then there was this, what people call the social justice aspects, which were expunging convictions for possession and sale of cannabis. It doesn't make a lot of sense to have people in jail or being convicted for stuff that's now legal, right? And as I was reading about it, people were saying, well, there are certain legislators who are for legalizing it, but they object to the social justice parts and therefore won't vote for it. And then there were other legislators who thought, you know, the social justice parts were terrific, but they had problems with either the taxation or the regulation or some aspect of, you know, maybe the amount that could be grown or the amount that could be harvested by people. So the idea was that this got the bill into trouble, and then it didn't pass in the regular session. But then in the special session, which again, you're sponsoring it, you divide it up and both pass. So, you know, was the whole like less than the sum of its parts? Were people just misreading what the support of the bills was? Or how do you see that?
Yeah, so I think that in the regular session that the bill didn't pass simply because it ran out of time. You know, I had a reporter call me and ask me that question, why did it fail? And I said, well, it failed because we didn't have another 36 hours. If we had another 36 hours, it would have passed.
So you think the votes were there to begin with?
I think so. I think the votes were on the floor of the Senate to begin with. I think what happened at the end, though, is, you know, those last 5 days of legislative sessions, you know, the clock is your enemy, right? And I think that that's what we're up against. We did have Senate Republicans and House Republicans filibustering everything at the end. And so there were a lot of other bills that were going to get caught up had we proceeded with a cannabis vote on the floor of the Senate those last 48 hours. So I think we all made a calculation that we would, we would pursue it through a different process, be it a special session or whatnot. Now, with regard to the previous question, remember that the expungement mechanisms, which ended up in a separate bill, that's only one small part of the social justice components of the cannabis legalization bill. In fact, the entire Cannabis Regulation Act, as passed and signed by the governor, is a document that is written through the lens of racial and economic justice. Everything from the licensing structure to, the advisory board, the public health aspects of the bill, it's all drafted through a lens that is committed to racial and economic justice. That's why, when we were working together with the Senate and trying to come up with a way to get these bills passed, and once it was suggested that we pull out the expungement mechanisms and run them through a separate bill, it makes sense to me. I mean, when you look at expungement, that is strictly a criminal justice procedure, right? And so if it made some folks feel a little bit better by splitting them, that was okay. As long as we had commitments to pass both of them, right? Because ultimately we were not going to pass one without the other. And we had those commitments from the governor on down. Meaning
that if one passed and not the other, she would veto it?
Well, I don't know that it would ever get to that point of whether or not she would have to veto one of them. But we were all on the same page that both had to pass. And if you look at the way the special session worked out, we started cannabis on the House side, we started expungement on the Senate side, and then they both tracked parallel, right, to one another. And we timed it so that both would eventually get to the governor really within hours of the other. So, I think that was a smart choice by the leadership of the House and Senate. Let's not forget that the entire Cannabis Regulation Act is embedded with social justice and racial justice. And I was I was laughing yesterday. I was on a Zoom meeting with constituents about this, and I was joking with them, and I said, look, social justice is not contained in one standalone section of the Cannabis Regulation Act. the entire document is written through that lens, through that perspective. And that's really, I believe, how government should operate. That's how every single bill should be written, in my opinion. We should always have racial, economic, gender, justice embedded in legislation to ensure that we are achieving equity for those most impacted by the bills that we pass.
And you would think that in a majority-minority state, that would be achievable. But I guess in my estimation, this is the first real session where I saw that actually happening.
Well, you know, let's not forget, right, that it's not enough to have people of color in positions of power. You know, we lost a decade under the nation's first Latina governor, Susana Martinez. We lost a decade. You know, we had net population decreases during those 8 years. She devastated the mental behavioral health system here in New Mexico. So it's not enough to have people of color in power. It's what we need are people that are conscious, people that are committed to equity and justice in every position, from governor all the way down to police chief and everything in between.
So that we're nearing the end of the show, Javier, and this discussion sort of leads into a good closing, which is, you know, so the last sessions, the special and the regular, were sort of a high watermark in the 20 years I've been in New Mexico for progressive legislation. And I'm wondering what you think the future holds. I mean, was this just an aberration because some Republican and conservative Democrat senators lost in the 2020 election and we got a surprising result? Or do you think that this is the new normal, that we're going to have this focus on equality and minority rights as we continue on?
That's a great question, Stephen. I don't think this was an aberration, and I think that this was a long time coming. I think the primary election of 2020 that ousted a number of senators, I think that was just another piece of a much longer process. Let's not forget everything that the House of Representatives has done over the last 4 years to build a majority that I wouldn't necessarily tag as progressive or liberal. It's a majority that really cares about people and that really cares about policies that are going to have a positive impact on all of our communities. You know, now that we've got this constitutional amendment to the voters, now that we got a fair and just Cannabis Regulation Act, now that we have tax reform that really benefits low-income and working families, you know, the future is very bright.
We are going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank today's guest, State Representative Javier Martinez. Thanks also to my producer, Tristan Klum. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of the show are available wherever you get podcasts. Past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.